The High Court has given a potentially very significant judgment in relation to rights to light in the case of Beaumont Business Centres versus Florala Properties, involving a development on Moorgate and London Wall. In the latest episode of On the Case, I am joined by Andrew Francis, a barrister at Searle Court Chambers, co-author of the book Rights of Light, the Modern Law, and author of Restrictive Covenants and Freehold Land, a Practitioner's Guide. He's with me to discuss the implications of Beaumont versus Florala. First off, Andrew, can you outline the facts of the dispute for us?
The dispute is all about a right of light claim in the City of London at the northern end of Coleman Street and Moorgate, just north of the Bank of England. Mm-hmm. The claimant, Beaumont, owned the freehold to what is known as numbers 80A Coleman Street, and on the other side, on the east side, 63 to 65 Moorgate, between the two streets. And the defendant owned all but one property immediately to the north of Beaumont's property, namely 67 to 73 Moorgate and 34 London Wall. Defendant, that is Florala, and I shall refer to it as Florala. Florala had, in outline, built an extension to the buildings which faced into a light well, which gave light into Beaumont's property. They did this building between July 2017 and July 2018, and it was that building, that extra building on top of the existing buildings, that caused a loss of light to Beaumont's property or buildings. In fact, it's notable that there was not a huge degree of loss of light to Beaumont's buildings. In rights of light terms, and using a technical phrase, it was 270 square feet equivalent first zone, or EFZ. That was what the dispute was about in summary. There was quite a lot of background and a lot of the time taken at what turned out to be a six-day trial before Peter Knox, QC, sitting as a deputy judge of the High Court, Business and Property Courts, was taken up by looking at the background evidence, live evidence, and also valuation matters that no doubt we will come to in due course.
I'm sure we will. So what were the sort of major battlegrounds in the case? What were the key arguments that were advanced on behalf of each side?
There were effectively six questions that the court had to decide. The first question, which was disposed of pretty quickly in favour of Beaumont, was whether or not Beaumont had a right of light or could claim a right of light to all its windows in its building, and the answer to that was yes. The second question, which was somewhat more complicated, was whether or not Florala's extension caused a nuisance, effectively caused an actual interference to the light, and the answer to that was also yes. In that context, there were some lessons to be learned, or at least some takeaway points that no doubt we'll come back to in a moment or two, as to how you assess what is a nuisance to light, and it may well be that we should probably deal with those in due course. Mm-hmm. The third question was what damages should the claimant, that's Beaumont, get on a sort of straightforward common law loss of value point. The key question that then came up, the fourth question, was whether or not the claimant, Beaumont, should get an injunction. And the answer to that was yes, but on terms which I will refer to in a moment. The fifth point was if the claimant was entitled to an injunction in principle, should there then be a consideration and, if necessary, an award of negotiating damages in lieu of that injunction? And the lesson from that we'll look at in a moment in terms of assessment of negotiating damages. And then finally, the sixth point dealt with the terms of the injunction, and that raised a question concerning the fact that the defendant's tenant was not a party to the litigation. The defendant's tenant was, in fact, the occupier or lessee of the hotel which the defendant had built, and therefore there was a term in the judgment or a term in the order dealing with the fact that no injunction could take place until clarification of the tenant's position had been carried out. carried out.
Okay, so let's go through then in a bit more detail what the judge actually decided in Beaumont v. Florala, particularly in terms of the injunction, which I think is the major point addressed by the case.
Yes, it's worth stressing four points before we look at the remedy, because the remedy is really the key point that comes out of this judgment. The first is that, as I said, it was a six-day trial, and there was a lot of live evidence concerning the dealing between the parties, and it may be recalled that in 2018, the defendant, Florala, had sought to strike out Beaumont's claim on the basis that really this wasn't an injunction claim at all, it was only a money claim, a ransom claim. Mm-hmm. And His Honour Judge Hodge, in 2018, decided not to strike out the case, and therefore it proceeded to trial. One of the lessons in this case, which no doubt we will refer to later, is the fact that you must not ever assume, certainly if you're acting for the defendant, that simply that the claimant is all and only interested in money. A lot of the judgment is actually, as I say, dealing with the live evidence over the dealing between the parties, which took place between 2014 and about 2018. So there was quite a long history to the dealings between them. The second point is that the evidence showed that the claimant wasn't only interested in money, and the judge rejected the defendant's submissions that all it was in, that was all the claimant was interested in, was a ransom payment. The third point is actually, in fact, important to stress that Florala had actually acted in a neighbourly way, a sensible way, at the early stages of the difference or the development between the parties until about 2016, and then the dispute arose in a pretty fierce way between the parties. So what's again important there is that the neighbourly relationship between the parties had obviously broken down, and that was unfortunate for the end result. The fourth point, and this is a technical point which is very important in rights of light matters, is that neither side contended for the conventional valuation of light in rental values at £5 a square foot. Now, that was important because a lot of us who work in the rights of light field, both barristers, solicitors and surveyors, believe that the 40-something-year-old table or graph, which is in Mr. Anstey's, or late Mr. Anstey's book, and now maintained by Mr. Harris at Anstey Horn & Co., is out of date. It doesn't reflect the true value of light in rights of light cases in terms of letting values, and certainly not in the City of London. And therefore there was a lot of evidence, quite a large part of the judgment, is dealing with the experts, the two experts for each side, on the loss of letting value of the claimant's building, and the loss it suffered. It was obviously a commercially let building, and the question was how much was it to be treated as reduced by. In fact, it's worth noting at this stage that the loss in value was not a huge amount. It was of the order of just under, as found by the judge, £20,000 a year, not huge. And that, in fact, is also significant because, as we shall see in due course, the mere fact that the loss might be a small one doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to be injuncted.
So then turning then to the remedy that was granted by the judge, what did he rule in the case?
The judge made a mandatory order requiring Florala to cut back part of their building so as to remove the interference with light to a particular window identified in the claimant's building as one where the light or through which the light was going to be substantially lost. Therefore, that order was going to have to be worked out in due course in terms of its detail, and there was also a mandatory injunction to deal with other light to some of the other windows in the building. However, as I've said earlier, because the defendant's tenant wasn't a party to the proceedings, steps had to be taken to ensure that the defendant, who may or may not have known about these proceedings, going to have to be told about the effect of the order, and therefore directions were given, technical directions were given, to ensure that an opportunity was made so that the tenant could take part, if necessary, in terms of the resolution of the order.
Makes sense.
If that was not going to be done in what might be called a satisfactory way, or at least in a way that meant that the mandatory injunction was going to have to be, as it were, executed, then the judge made an order that the defendant was to pay the claimant the sum of £350,000 in damages together with interest, and that would have been, of course, also part of the technical working out of the order, which counsel would no doubt be working on post-judgment. As we will see in due course, the lesson from this case is that the prima facie remedy is that of the injunction. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the key point is that a mandatory injunction was granted and will be granted, and we'll look at that perhaps in due course when we look at the context in, or the context in which that order was made.
Yeah, obviously that's, I mean, it's, to be faced with an injunction of that kind is obviously a major blow for a defendant in the position of Florala, and it's a significant order to be forced to comply with. So what do you think will be the lasting effects of this decision, and what will it mean for developers going forward?
Well, I've identified about 7 points. I don't want to be too prescriptive in this. This is a long judgment. There's quite a lot of things to digest from it. But I think the first thing to say is we must remember, and it's, in my experience, something that people forget, is that the prima facie protection for interference with a property right is that of the injunction.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a covenant or an easement, whether it's an easement of light or any other right that's a property right, or indeed a trespass to land, the prima facie remedy is for a claimant to say to the court, this person must stop, or this bit of an infringement must be pulled down, or whatever the proper order is. Now, it's almost exactly just over 6 years ago that we had the seminal Supreme Court judgment in Fentigers. And people thought after that, or there was an inclination to think after that, that the courts had to use a phrase, gone soft on the remedy of the injunction. Well, they hadn't. The Supreme Court, particularly in Lord Newburger's speech and the other speeches, made it clear that the injunction is the starting point. Because what, of course, Fentigers said, and the Supreme Court said there, is, of course, you've got to look at all the evidence. There should be no inclination either way, as Lord Newburger said in his judgment. What had gone wrong with the law in the half dozen or so cases before Fentigers, before 2014, was that there had been a prescriptive approach to the granting or non-granting of the injunctive remedy. The Supreme Court said, well, you've got to look at this in the round. All the facts and circumstances have got to be taken into account. But we are still in the position of the prima facie remedy being the injunction. So that's the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And developers and all of us who are dealing with cases where there is land development or whatever, any sort or shape or size, have got to remember that planning consent and all the other things are quite irrelevant, because there are property rights, then they are to be protected. They are there. They trump everything else. And also, what's very important, the second point really, is that you can't treat all claims for injunctions simply ransom claims. In fact, the judge was also persuaded that it was appropriate to grant an injunction because, as he said at paragraph 340 of his judgment, Florala went ahead with the development knowing of the risk that it was taking and ignoring the offer to develop with a cutback, and it therefore acted in his judgment, the judge's judgment, in a high-handed, or at least unfair, and unneighbourly manner. So, after it, as I said earlier, been neighbourly, in from about 2016, it started being unneighbourly, and it went ahead with the works that it finished in the year between July 17 and July 18. So, the second point, really, as I say, is you've got to be really careful and not to treat claimants as simply wanting money. value in terms of rental values or letting values, small losses, don't necessarily mean that the claim is not an actionable one. The judge goes right back to the early cases at the beginning of the 20th century, particularly Coles and the Home and Colonial Stores, and cites the important passages in that House of Lords judgment. Question is the enjoyment of the property less comfortable and convenient as before? And that often translates into loss of rental value. So if there is a real injury beyond that which is trifling, so non-trifling injuries, that could be actionable. And in fact, even if the loss is 0% or very small, there could be other effects. For example, in residential properties, where the loss of amenity is, of course, pretty significant.
Mm.
For example, at the moment, we're all obviously rightly being ordered to stay at home. We therefore treat the amenities of our house, particularly light coming into our buildings or our houses or flats or whatever, as very important. Therefore, that's going to be significant. The fourth point is that badly lit rooms must be protected, and that's well known in the case, and an argument that was sought to be developed by the defendant's counsel was rejected by the judge. The claimant's counsel was right to emphasise the authorities, both English and Irish authorities, saying badly lit rooms, especially residential ones, for that matter, have to be protected. The fourth point is that Waldron test, which is the technical test for assessing whether or not a right of light has been interfered with, have stood the tests of time. They're there as a starting point. You can't ignore them, but equally, and it was done in this particular case, in the Beaumont case, you could bring in other standards, and there was evidence of the use of what's sometimes called the radiance test.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in that case, the Waldron test was used, and the loss, as I've said, the EFZ loss of about 270 square feet was the product of that. What wasn't done in that case, and I know there's been a lot of discussion in the rights of light world about it, is the use of the climate-based daylight modelling test, which is another test, a bit more sophisticated, using also reflected light. That wasn't done there, but the lesson in this case, it seems to me from the judge, is that the Waldron tests are still, or the Waldron test is still there. Finally, as I said earlier, you don't have to stick to the £5 a square foot formula.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not going to do that, and it seems to me to be sensible, especially in a property in the City of London, both sides' decision not to use the £5 a square foot formula, you will need clear and accurate valuation expert evidence on loss of letting values. And that's important, and in fact, a close reading of the judgment, which people might want to undertake, will look at the way in which both sides' experts and the judge came to their conclusions and the judge's conclusions on loss of letting value. As I said earlier, the loss per annum wasn't huge, it was just under £20,000 for the claimant's building. But that also is very important because it does show that an injunction will be granted even where the loss isn't huge.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wasn't small, and then to some extent it wasn't easily quantifiable in absolute terms, but the injunction was still there. One other little point just on that is causation may be relevant. Is this loss of light caused, or this loss of letting value caused, by something else? In the case, there was evidence about the demolition works carried out on another site next to the claimant's building called Kajima. Now, that was raised as a point which could have had an effect on the true cause of the loss. In essence, basically, this is a significant case where we do need to remember, ultimately, the key lesson that the injunction is the prima facie remedy.
So, I mean, obviously, all practitioners like yourself and barristers, solicitors, surveyors, everyone will be paying attention to this case. So how do you think advice to clients will change as a result of the judgment?
Well, I hope two things will happen. I'm sure that the members of both my profession, the solicitor's profession, and the rights of light surveyors profession, and anybody else who's advising, will be aware of this case and will have considered it, no doubt, either through your journal or through other sources.
Mm.
It would be depressing to see in these matters, particularly producing standard briefing notices, prefaces or appendices to Rights of Light or other reports, don't bring those up to date. I think this is the opportunity to bring them up to date to make sure that the current law, and indeed the law that's been around since 2014, since Fentigas, is reflected in the advice that's given to clients. The second piece of advice to give to clients is you can't sugar the pill. If it is the case that there are property rights, if you are acting for somebody who is seeking to do something that might infringe those property rights, the pill that the client has to be given is that there is a risk of an injunction. Obviously, there are a number of ways you get around that. For example, acting in a neighbourly manner, seeking to agree matters beforehand, to do the deeds and the deals that can be done. Maybe that there may be insurance as last resort in some cases, indemnity insurance. But and the other thing, of course, is to remind clients, especially the less savvy clients, is that, of course, a planning consent isn't the end of the matter. So whatever the planning consent may say, and of course we know that in planning matters the standard for interference with daylight and sunlight under the Building Research Establishment standards is different.
Mm-hmm.
In rights of light matter civil cases, one still has to remember that the principles are different, and therefore that we have to tell the clients that even though the development has satisfied the BRE standards, it may not necessarily be the case if we're looking at property rights. The other point, of course, worth mentioning in this vein is that it may not just be a right of light that's a problem. I have a number of cases which come across my desk where we have not just rights of light, we have other easements, we have potential trespass and boundary issues, and we have restricted covenants and everything else. There's one final point that might come out of the proverbial woodwork in this following this decision, and it's this. As we all know, local authorities and other bodies, local planning authorities and other bodies, which includes Transport for London and all sorts of other bodies, under Section 203 of the Housing and Planning Act of 2016, have the ability to override covenants and easements and other rights in certain fairly strictly defined circumstances. Given the heightened, or I'd say not exactly heightened, but given the reminder of the injunction risk following Beaumont, whether people will want to go back to think about whether it is possible to engage with a local authority or other body with the right powers to override the right is another matter.
Mm.
And there is also just one final point. Negotiating damages, which also feature in the judgment, and as I say, it came to the total of £350,000, mustn't also be forgotten as the prima facie remedy in lieu of an injunction. In other words, you're going to be looking at negotiating damages and not just capital loss. I would just say two things about that. The first is that it's tempting for surveyors and other advisors here to stick to the hallowed formula of what we sometimes call book value times some notional enhancement. My personal view, and I know it's shared with a number of surveyors and other professionals in this field, is that's wrong. That approach is wrong for a number of reasons, partly because it starts with the £5 a square foot conventional amount. Now that, we can see now in Beaumont, was a point not pressed by either side. Both sides accepted, as I've said, that was not the right approach. The second point is that there is no formula, there's no multiplier that you can say is the correct one. It's got to be a sum that reflects the economic value of the right to build, as we were reminded almost exactly 2 years ago by the Supreme Court in Morris Garner. So the real question is, what is the economic value of the developer's building so far as it interferes, the value of the cutback? And that cannot, in my view, be expressed simply by a formulaic approach, which is taking what we sometimes call book value and then enhancing it by some notional amount. So, again, we need to educate our clients to ensure that a
Okay, well, thank you for that that summary of the implications and significance of the case. Now, one thing we should note, of course, is that Beaumont v. Florala is a decision at High Court level, and that still leaves considerable room for scrutiny by the higher courts. Do you think this is a case that's likely to go to appeal?
I can't say at the moment whether this is likely to go to appeal for two reasons. First of all, I've not been able to make contact with either counsel in current circumstances. Mm. That would be difficult to know whether there is any intelligence on whether anybody has made an application, or particularly for the defendants to file an application for permission to appeal, either in front of the judge or indeed in front of the court of appeal itself. So on the factual question, I don't know, and it may well be that we will know fairly soon. Secondly, whether it's likely to go to appeal, it seems to me that there might be some points, particularly on the remedy, but given the nature of the discretion and the way in which the judge has analysed the proper position on the remedy, I clearly can't speak for the Court of Appeal, but it looks as if it's reasonably bomb-proof. Again, that's just my personal view.
Yeah.
As we all know, to get to the Court of Appeal or get the Court of Appeal even interested, you have to show that either the judge was wrong or that there was a wrong exercise of discretion, and it's, you know, it's basically going to be a case that has a good prospect of success in the Court of Appeal. The various tests in Part 52. I think it would be wrong of me to speculate further, and I would therefore propose that one simply takes this judgment, at least at the present, as it is, and observes it, and then we see whether or not the Court of Appeal ever get to it, and then we see what they say then.
And of course you'll be monitoring that closely, because as we mentioned at the start, you are the co-author of Rights of Light, the Modern Law, and I gather you're working on the fourth edition right now, to the extent that social distancing and remote working are enabling you.
Well, fortunately, unlike the days when I was working in the estate agent office, where we simply had manual typewriters and Romeo copiers and at some parts, certainly in a three-day week, no electric light, I can at least do my part of it with my colleagues, Tom Weeks QC and Robert Cohen, and the aim is to get this book out, all being well, and all the other problems that we've got in the course of the summer, but we're certainly working on the fourth edition, and I'm sure that the various lessons learnt and the points made by the very full and comprehensive and useful judgment of Peter Knox QC will come out in various parts of the book.
Okay, well, good luck, best of luck in getting that finished, and thank you very much for joining us today to discuss Beaumont versus Florala.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to join you.
It's a pleasure. You have been listening to On the Case from EG.